This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Michael C. and Sue, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Monica M. will now read the preamble.
I'm Monica, a grateful alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve the common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Monica. Now we will say the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Harry O. will read the steps.
Hi, my name is Harry. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Michael B. will now read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. The traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based upon attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Anthony.
Hi, my name is Anthony. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
I had a little surprise when I walked in today. I have my mother and my sister over here. I did not expect to see them here. And thank you for coming. I was thinking to myself, you know, well, now I'm really going to have to hold back on my story. You know, I can't. But they were there. I mean, they saw it all. There's not much I can really say that they don't know. I mean, when I remember my first drunk when I was, it was that first night, so when I was 13, drank a bottle of Southern Comfort, and I was in bed throwing up. It was my mom who came and cleaned it up, you know, and cleaned me up. And when I was a young teenager and I ran away from home, you know, to become a professional delinquent, it was my family that came, you know, to Francis Boulevard, chasing me down the street, trying to get me to come home, you know. And when I would go on my binges and I'd be missing for however long a period of time, it was my sister who would arrange search parties to come find me. So they know, you know, they know it all. They've been there, they've lived it, you know. And, you know, I'm sorry for all that. And, you know, I've tried to make my amends to the best of my ability, and I'll continue to do that. I think the reason I'm up here speaking tonight, it's just kind of a special occasion for me and for my family. I'm moving to Louisiana this weekend, so this will be my last Atlantic Group meeting as a New Yorker, but I will always consider myself to be an Atlantic Grouper. And I hope one day that I'll be able to come back here and bring you glad tidings from the Gulf Group of Lafayette, Louisiana. But that, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself right now, so we'll see. So, you know, I started drinking at an early age. I wound up in my first program at around 18 years old. About 16, everyone else knew I had a problem. By the time I was 18, I knew I had a problem, and I was ready to try to do something about it. I wasn't successful. I was successful here and there, on and off. I haven't been able to maintain permanent sobriety up until 1998. I turned the age of 30, and I've been sober ever since. You know, I've hit multiple bottoms during the years between 18 and 30, and the bottoms just kind of kept getting worse and worse. And the last bottom, although physically I was probably not in the worst shape I've ever been, emotionally and spiritually I was, and it was my 30th birthday, August of 98, and I found myself, you know, wanting to commit suicide. And that's what brought me to the state of willingness to come back and try a 12-step fellowship again, although it hadn't worked before. And it was that willingness that brought me back into the rooms somewhere around, actually on November 4th, 1998, and I started seeking an answer to my problem. You know, the psychiatrist had said she wouldn't prescribe any medications, which was very depressing to me. And whenever I drank, I got depressed. And whenever I didn't drink, I got depressed. So, you know, I didn't have an answer. You know, I was out of solutions. And I started looking around all sorts of different fellowships and all sorts of different places. It wasn't until I found the Atlantic Group that I knew that I had found what I was looking for. I started coming here. When I first came here, I did not like it. There were a lot of people, and everyone was happy. And that wasn't me. You know, I was resentful. I was fearful. I didn't know how to socialize. I was scared of everyone around me. And it took me a while to get used to being here. Luckily, I got a sponsor, I think, within my first week. His name is Rick R. He's in this room. He became my sponsor then. He's still my sponsor today. I worked the steps with him multiple times. He's taken me through the book. And I have sponsees. But anyway, let me get back to the beginning. So the first year was really rough. And I came to this group, and they gave me a commitment. I was on the striker committee, and that was like the cleanup committee. I think that was the name back then. And that really helped me. It was the perfect commitment for me because I didn't have to socialize a lot. You know, I was able to do my job and, you know, be a part of the group and not really, you know, have to socialize with too many people. Thank you. And then the second year, I became the co-chair of the anniversary watch. And I had to take a crash course in socialization at that point. For those of you who don't know what the anniversary watch is, you get together in a diner for 3 hours, and you are forced to make conversation with people, and sometimes you don't know who these people are, but that's okay, you know. And I learned quick, and I think it was a good lesson for me, and I have since learned how to socialize. I can be around people who I don't know and make pleasant conversation, and, you know, and I don't have to be drunk, you know, because if you, in my younger years, or even, you know, throughout my active years, you know, if you gave me alcohol, I was a pretty sociable person. You know, of course, towards the end, that all ended, and I became, you know, unsociable. But So I started getting better. You know, I started becoming emotionally sober. I got a relationship with a higher power. I became able to maintain relationships. I rebuilt relationships with my family. You know, at one point I told you that they would chase me down the block to try to get me to come home. Well, at the end, they would lock the doors to keep me out. And my mother couldn't leave me alone in a room with her pocketbook. Because she knew something would be stolen, or they were afraid to keep, you know, to let me in the house without some kind of supervision. But that's changed. You know, today I have the keys in my mother's house. I have a good relationship with my family, and that's all changed. Thank you. Thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and the Atlantic Group. During my sobriety, I met my wife, Jeannie. We met at the California Pizza Kitchen. So if you're ever going to knock going out after the meeting, you might want to think twice. You can meet your future mate there. We met at the California Peach Kitchen, and we had a courtship, you know, that turned into a marriage, and we had our first child in 2004, and we had our second child in 2006. We were married in 2003, and I promised my wife. We did. It was really quick work, and I promised my wife before we got married that I would move down south if we were to get married, and I made a promise to her that we would move closer to her family, and so we got married. And we made attempts to go south. You know, I wasn't going to move south without a job there. And so we put in the footwork. Well, she put in the footwork. And I continued to do my job, which I considered to be, you know, earning a living and trying to get better at what I do, you know, and staying sober. And she did the footwork on sending out the resumes and all that. And we prayed, you know, and we had people praying for us. And, you know, we had some leads early on, and they didn't pan out. And at some point within the past few months, I was thinking that maybe it wasn't going to happen. You know, that maybe it was time to think about settling down in New York. And you know, I make a go of it here. You know, we had been renting. We decided not to own anything because we wanted to be able to leave at any given moment. And so it was about, I don't remember, it was a Monday. I don't remember, sometime in November, I think. And I went, and I said to Jeannie, I said, Jeannie, I think it's time. I think it's time to sell down. I think it's time to just stay here. And it was 2 days later that I got the call from a bank in Louisiana saying, you know, we're interested and we think it's time. And I went through and I did the footwork. And I did the footwork and I did everything that I was told to do. And I, you know, prayed upon it and prayed on it and just kept on doing the next right thing. And the job came through and I was made an offer. And I came back to New York and I handed in my resignation. And I went back to Louisiana to be with Jeannie, who was there on vacation with her family. And while I was there on vacation, my current company called and said, you know what, we'd like you to stay on with us, but you can work from Louisiana. So, you know, I thought about it for a little while, and considering, you know, I wouldn't have to change compensation benefits or all my contacts, I accepted the offer. And, you know, you want to talk about beyond your wildest dreams, that wasn't even in the plan. You know, it wasn't in the picture. And I've been given the goodbye. So I just want to thank everybody in this room. I know, like, this first, I don't know, 10 rows, I spent the first, you know, what I consider to be 9 years of my rebirth with you. So thank you very much.
And our second 10-minute speaker tonight is Pam.
Good. Thanks. Hi, I'm Pam. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. It's really wonderful. I think I was shuffling around in my black stretch pants and my slip-on sneakers with no makeup for way too long, and, you know, the speaker chair caught up with me, you know, my higher power. You know, it's time for me to do some service around here. You know, I got up this morning, and the alarm went off at 5:30, had some coffee. My wonderful husband makes me coffee every morning. Said coffee was ready, and called my sponsor, did my prayers, and then I listened to a CD of Bill Wilson, our founding father, one of our founding fathers, qualifying in 1950 on the day that Dr. Bob died. And all this happened before 7:30 in the morning, you know? And then I had breakfast, got ready, and I made a 9 o'clock appointment this morning. And I thought, oh, geez, you know, 2.5 years ago, my sobriety date is June 5th, 04. My home group is the Atlantic Group, and my sponsor is Marie. 2.5 years ago, what would have happened? The alarm would have gone off, certainly not at 5:30. And I would have been coming to. And I would have hit the snooze alarm for an hour to 2 hours. And then I would have gotten up, dragged myself out of bed, and I would have thought, oh, God, what did I do again last night? You know, what happened? Like, you know, I was a controlled drinker, and I had a planned, you know, pint of vodka that I had to drink within a certain time frame every night so that I could get up and go to work every day. But I always bought the reserve pint just in case. And it was like, you know, did I do it again? You know, I don't know. I couldn't remember because the last 2 years of my drinking, I was drinking every night. And I was blacking out every night. And I was arguing and doing really hurtful things to my husband every night. And I don't know what I was doing. And when I came to, I had no idea except for that I was coming to. And I was dry heaving, and I could barely get to work in the morning. And I was scrambling to figure out what I had done, you know, like I was running to the kitchen, like, did I drink that reserve bottle or not, you know? And I was scrambling in the freezer looking for it, and, you know, and sure enough, there it was next to the garbage. And it was like, oh, God, you know, here I go again. And it was over every single day I did that same thing. And when I was on my way to work, I was dry heaving in that taxi. And I was praying then. I was praying that I didn't vomit in that taxi on the way to work. I wasn't praying and saying to God, if you don't let me vomit, you know, I won't do it again. I was telling myself I wasn't going to do it again, but I was just praying that I didn't vomit. And, you know, by, you know, the afternoon, there I was planning my drink again. And, you know, I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. And that's where my disease had taken me 2.5 years ago before I came here. You know, and alcohol wasn't always, you know, it wasn't always that bad. Alcohol was once my friend. I picked up the drink when I was 18, and back then the legal drinking age was 18, so I'm kind of dating myself. It was legal then, and, you know, I went to college, I had my first drink, which is really my first drunk, because, you know, for my very first drink, I got drunk, and it felt good. It felt really good, because then I could have a normal conversation with a guy without having empty airspace, you know, and I felt like I was, you know, in and happening and a normal human being. So alcohol was my friend. It was my elixir to normalcy. And then I started to chase that for the next 29 years. So, you know, I didn't know I had a problem for many, many years. I was a party girl. I started on the weekends, and it took me all the way to being a nightly drinker. You know, to the newcomer, this disease is a progressive disease. That means that it gets worse. The longer you drink, the more you drink, it gets worse. I didn't understand that because I didn't know I had a problem until like the last 10 years of my drinking career. You know, if you're here, obviously you think or someone has said that you have a problem. So take note, it gets bad. You know, I look back, you know, when I was drinking, I didn't think I had a problem. I got drunk all the time, but there were no side effects. You know, nothing bad ever happened to me. But as I look back on my drinking career, there were a lot of bad things happened to me. You know, I got sick all the time. I may not have blacked out, but I got sick all the time. I had hangovers all the time. And by the grace of God, I'm standing here, and I didn't kill anybody, but I was in a car driving, and there were many close calls. So I'm very fortunate, and I guess I'm here to pass this message to you guys. Thank you. So, you know, when I was young, I could stop drinking, but I didn't know I had a problem, so I never, you know, came here or sought treatment. When I was old, which is what I am now, I couldn't stop drinking. I had to seek treatment. I couldn't stop. I'd wake up in the morning with convulsions shaking so bad I couldn't put it down, so I had to seek treatment. And with the help of my loving, supportive husband and my therapist, I got treatment. And thank you, God, for that. So I went away for treatment, and it taught me how to do this program. And they prepared me for the next leg of my journey. They told me to get a sponsor, find a home group, and that's what I did. I got Marie. She had me sign up for the Atlantic group. You know, I searched for the Atlantic group because I wasn't happy. I'm a very picky person. I need to have beauty. You know, I was in an industry where beauty meant everything. So I joined the Atlantic group, and I did what she told me to do, one foot in front of the other, and that's what I did. And, you know, 10 months into my sobriety, I lost my job. You know, you're not supposed to lose your job, but that was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. You know, I hated my job. I hated my industry. For 21 years, I was in that industry. It was all about the money for me, all about the money, and I hated it. So for a year, I was lucky. I got to take off. So what did I do? I dove into the center of this program because that's what my sponsor and my sober family told me to do. So I got commitments. I went to meetings at least 7 days a week, if not more. I did the steps. I did prayers with prayer partners. I did everything that I was told to do. And then after my year was up, I celebrated my first year anniversary. I got sponsees. And I had a really great AA foundation. Then it was time to get a job. And I was freaking out. Like, what was I going to do? You know, I didn't want to go back to my industry. I hated that industry. Or, you know, I was going to get drunk again if I had to go back to that industry. Sure enough, I went and volunteered to the treatment facility where I got help. And I volunteered. And then they offered me a job. They had a part-time job here in New York City working out of my apartment. You know, how good does it get? Within 6 months, they offer me a full-time job. How good does that get? You know, and I'm just doing this, putting one foot in front of the other. So here I am here with love people. Here I am there with love people, you know, of people that just keep me in the center, in the core of this program all the time. You know, and I'm so fortunate for that. And I have to tell you something else. In October, I had to have back surgery. It was really painful for me, and, you know, I suffer with a lot of pain with back, and as I know a lot of you do here, I landed in the hospital. And I have to tell you that the support that came to me from all the angels in this group was just amazing. What this taught me is there are so many people that I look up to here and that I strive, you know, to be like, because they set such an incredible power of example to me. People came to me. They called me. I mean, I didn't ask anybody to come. They just showed up. And people have their own problems here. They didn't tell me about their problems. They showed up. They brought me food. They brought me coffee. You know, they brought me books. They read prayers to me. They brought me meetings at home. My mother came from Florida. My mother cooked for me. And as Bonnie was a witness to, my mother was making me lunch. My mother's 77 years old. She comes into the bedroom one day and she says, she's making me a sandwich. She goes, do you want it on toast or plain bread? Now, I got to tell you something. If I were still drinking, do you think there'd be a chance in the world that my mother at age 77 would be coming in my bedroom saying, do you want it on toast or plain? You know, I'd be lucky if I weren't locked up in Bellevue right now in the locked ward if I were still drinking. So to me, you know, the job, the friends, you know, the all these people, powers of example, these are the cash and prizes of this program. I'm a happy person. I don't have to go back into an industry, you know, where everybody is backstabbing, manipulative, political. These people have taught me so much that I want to strive to be. They call me every day to see how I'm doing. They come visit me even if they're hurting or if they're having family problems. You know, they're looking after me. And they're taking care of me. They're bringing me meetings. And they're teaching me. And these, you know, this is everybody here at the Atlantic Group. I mean, the Atlantic Group is amazing for this. The sobriety is so good. The sponsorship's great. The meetings are wonderful here. I mean, it's all about living in the solution here at the Atlantic Group. You know, so if you're a newcomer here, please stay here. It's just wonderful. And in closing, I'd like to thank my sponsor and grand sponsor, Sober Families, and my husband for sticking by me, because without anybody and all you guys here, I certainly wouldn't be here today. Thank you.
The main speaker tonight is Dan. Dan R.
Hello, everybody. My name is Danny. I'm an alcoholic. And I thank Helen for asking me to speak. She didn't tell me it was this type of, this big a group. I thought I was coming into a regular, 20 people group. So, but, so it's quite, I was wondering why she said dress up. But it's an honor, and all I can tell you is that the power of God is alive and well in this room. And, it's unbelievable. You know, I can stand before you right now. I'm a free man. I greet each day. I basically greet each day with love in my heart. And I try to treat all my fellow human beings with love, patience, tolerance, and joy. And I slowed my life down, and I don't overreact. And I learned that through the recovery in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Been coming for 19 years. And all I could say, so many people stood up and they're new. This is the place. You know, you don't have to drink again, and you're safe now. And I know I needed to hear that when I first came in here. So it's a great. I mean, it's good to know I can wake up every day, and I basically don't have any resentments against anybody, and I don't believe anybody has any against me, and that's very freeing for me. I live my life basically. I'm an active member in my group, Serenity by the CAM in Long Beach, out in Long Island. I'm the treasurer in the group, and I've been active ever since I came in. And this group gives everybody great opportunity. But it didn't start out that way for me. 19 years ago, I found myself up on the steps of Graymore, okay, homeless, okay, as a result of 23 years of alcoholic drinking and other assorted things. And I stood there with a paper bag. And I had to walk into a room and strip down and be hit with disinfectant, the louse, they call it, which I didn't know what that meant, but that's what it was. And I felt the lowest that you could possibly feel as a human being. I was totally like a puddle, you know. I felt like a loser. Like, how did this ever happen to me? I hadn't seen my children in over a year. I was homeless through all of 1987. I couldn't support myself. I had become a thief. And literally, I lived in the streets for all of 1987. And, to stand here today, it's not like that today. So I have a wonderful life. I have everything I could possibly need, It's probably a few more things I want, but I don't need them. You know, whatever God gives is plenty for me. I have a loving family and friends, and that's all I could ask. How did I wind up in Graymore? Basically, I grew up or was dropped into this world in Woodside, Queens. My father was like 58 years old when I was born. My mother was 42. And they, you know, my early memories are of my father beating the heck out of my mother. He was an alcoholic. I can remember holding the door back while he was trying to smash the door in to kick our butts. Okay? And that's what I remember. And I remember then they decided to send me down to Catholic school and I ran into the nuns. And they taught me another world that, you know, it was time that, you know, if you committed any sins, you were going to hell. And I pretty much said, well, I'm in big trouble. So I guess that's where I'm going. And they beat the brains out of me all through grammar school. And, my only saving grace I had as a child was I was an excellent athlete. And I really prided myself. I mean, I used to win races and Cub Scouts and all that type of stuff. And I really got a lot out of sports. So my teenage years, I picked up my first drink I remember was a pint of Gallo red wine. And, at 12 years old, and I remember being like laid out at the bottom of my stairs and being carried up into my house. I never drank red wine again. Okay? I was not really a red wine drinker, but I loved to drink, and drinking I did. And basically my teenage years really were pretty much like, you know, as far as I knew, the same way everybody else's was. We played sports, we went, you know, you had to go to school to go, because you had to go to school, not that I wanted to go to school. I would pass the subjects that I didn't have to study for, and I would cheat on the ones that I did. And I got through school, and I played a lot of sports, and I loved it. You know, I wasn't drinking every day, and there was a lot of fun with it, too. But, you know, I mean, you know, until you came about 15, 16, drinking actually started becoming a weekend thing all the time. A lot of other assorted, it was the, I think I was born in 51, so, you know, 65, anybody who was around from 65 to 80 knows there was a lot of other things going on, and I was doing all of those, too, believe me. But drinking was the main thing in our neighborhood. There was different levels of crowds. And a lot of sports, you know, a lot of softball teams and playing ball and football and basketball. I was a good athlete. But we loved to drink. We loved to party. We used to, you know, that was the whole thing. For me, it was really drinking and chasing women. That's, you know, if I could have that forever with no consequences, I'd probably still be doing it. You know, there's no doubt about it. The problem is the consequences started to show up. But not always. In the beginning, I like to say it was 95% fun and 5% trouble. But that progressive slide over the years was like a meter that went along. Not that I knew it, but looking back now, you could see it. You know, I knew nothing about AA, nothing about alcoholism, nothing about any of that. All I knew about was drinking, partying, having a good time. And I thought it was a good time. But I went to high school. I played high school baseball and all that type of stuff. I was just a very natural athlete, and I got a lot of out of that. We played in a million leagues, like softball leagues. But everything was about the game, drinking before the game, having the game, drinking after the game, going to the bar, hanging out, and talking about the game, talking about the next game, and then, you know, and then trying to pick up a girl, you know. And for me, I only had two criterias: one, that they would get high with me, and one, that we would have sex. And that was my criteria, and they liked me. It wasn't much more than that. You know, if they said they liked me, we had a date. And that's really the way it went. And in all reality, that's how most of my life went for many, many years. And even after I got married, I thought, you know, the husband was allowed to date. You know. I should have been born in the Roman era. You know, that's what I believed, you know. And basically what happened is I went through high school, barely graduated high school. I did play baseball. It got me by a lot of different things. And eventually I got, and it was a lot of insanity. I leave out the parts of the stolen cars, the joyriding, getting arrested, being in 109th precinct, getting a juvenile delinquent card, because we were arrested for stolen cars and for fireworks. You know, brilliant strategies of, you know, throwing garbage cans through windows. You know, in my neighborhood, this was normal. You know, egging people. You know, that's what we did. And I didn't know any different. I thought it was fun. Okay. the Hamptons were in vogue, so, you know, it was like, you know, who had a car, get in a car, have a case of nips to drive out to the Hamptons, and drive out to the Hamptons, and hang out, and go to the Bawdy Barn, and hang out there, and just party. Knew the bartender, you know, we were professional drinkers. You knew right away, you come in, you grease the bartender, you were going to get taken care of for the whole night. And then there was other things that would keep us awake for the rest of the weekend, so we could drink all weekend. And then, whatever. And then Monday came and we'd have to come back to the, you know, to the world. And that's really how my life went. Went on and on and on. I wound up, after a year after high school of a lot of insanity, I wound up going down to Wall Street to get a job. And the first week I was there, my boss took me to the bar. And I was like, this is beautiful. My boss just endorsed drinking. And if you've worked in Wall Street, everybody endorses drinking down there. And I literally, I was always pretty good person as far as competing. I had a very winning attitude. I really believed that I would beat you in everything. And, you know, and I really could put in a lot of effort. So I really got into work at the time. You know, I was able to drink to one in the morning, get up in the morning, 6 o'clock, go to work, be in there before you and hustle. And, you know, I considered myself bright, you know, no genius, but bright enough to do what I had to do. And I moved up the ladder down on Wall Street. And drinking was a big part of it. I wound up, I still played a lot of sports. I met my wife, I believe you met your wife in a pizza place or something. I met my wife in a bar. That's where I met my wife, in a drinking bar that was a football league that after the games, you drank as much as you could possibly drink for free. And that's where I met my wife. And then I followed the Irish rhythm method and knocked out 3 kids in 4 years. And had her right where I wanted her. I didn't know all this at the time, but she was at home. I was working. I could stay out because I was becoming a manager and I had to solve the world's problems after work. You know, and down there in the bars, McCann's, all of them, the Parlor Car, all the bars. I became a manager. I had cab vouchers. So, you know, it was great. I could get hammered. And hammered I used to get, you know, blackouts, you know, and I just thought they came with the territory. But I could, as long as I called for a cab, I got home. I never knew how I got home, but I always seemed to get home. And this went on, and I was getting promoted. And a lot of other things, insanity, were going on in my life. You know, my home life was, you know, the typical, just like my father's, fighting and arguing. I didn't ever beat my wife. I never hit her, thank God. But I was emotionally traumatizing my family, you know, with all the nonsense. And again, I was a carouser at night, chasing women, and I regret that today, but at the time, that's what I did. And that went on and on and on. Eventually, it got to the point where we weren't getting along too well, and my drinking was a little bit out of control. And so she decided, you know, I told her, you know, if you can't let me go to hell, I'm leaving. And I left, and I said, she'll be sorry. So I did what most people at that age did. I moved back with my mother. Okay, so. And I decided, you know what, you know, the hell with her. I'll show her. And all of a sudden, though, my drinking started to get to the point where it was getting a little worse now, where I started to, you know, I was into scotch. You know, I really like scotch. And I would, I didn't like ice, and I didn't like water. So. And I started to drink a little bit. I didn't know it at the time. I knew nothing about AA. And I started to really get hammered at night, like knocking down tall glasses of scotch to go to sleep. I was still at the point where it was pretty much bad. I wound up going to my boss into work and said, things are out of hand. I need to take a break from work. So I asked him to fire me. He fired me. I got a job as a local bartender. And I started collecting food stamps and became a bookie. And I was the local bartender, which I loved. I thought it was terrific. I loved because I was in charge of the bar now. So when women came in, whatever, you drank for free, the guys paid double. And you know, and it's amazing, you know, they like you, the women, when you do that, especially the ones that I like to hang out that would stay out for after hours and all that type of stuff. And that went on for a full year. It was total insanity. And again, I had children at the time. And I love to tell everybody how beautiful my kids were while I spent all the money that I had and spent nothing on them. I knew nothing about love and what love meant at all. You know, love to me was sex. That's all love was and whatever I could get from it. Okay. So eventually what happened is I went back to Wall Street. Somehow I gathered the strength to get a job. I knew I needed to get out of that life. And I wound up getting a job down there again, and it was back to the races again. And then I got a promotion. I went on an interview, and I got Mother Merrill hired me as a manager, and I wound up, next thing I know, I'm moving up the ladder again. You know, I'm moving up the ladder, and I'm a raging drunk, and but everybody else is too, so it didn't seem to matter. But I still could show up for work and do my job. That was the amazing thing about it. I didn't know about AA, but I did know about, I was a little bit nervous in the morning. And I knew that if I went to the bar at 10:30 and knocked down a couple of Bloody Marys, I felt better. I did not know anything about the alcoholism that was occurring in me and what was kicking up. So what would happen is, that's how I live. You know, I would get hammered again. There was other things I would do to keep me awake during the day, and then there was other things I would do that knocked me out at night. And that's how I started to live. And it got to the point after many years, they put me in a management training program now. Now they gave me where I was going around to different departments to find out what they were teaching in the departments, and the managers didn't even want you there. So I was like, nobody really knows what I'm doing. I was spending half my days in the bar, and I was getting away with this. But one thing led to another. I got another job. And along the line here, many of my friends started dropping off the face of the earth from either overdoses, murders. You know, it was unbelievable. I've lost a lot of friends. I had people committing suicide. These were best friends of mine from the abuse of alcoholism, which I didn't know really at the time. And so what happened was I eventually got to the point where I met another. I actually went to AA for 90 days and asked my wife to take me back, and she told me, take a hike. And so I left. I didn't go to, I left AA. I only came to get her back. And then I met this girl who was a drug dealer, and I thought I was in heaven. Now, you know you have a problem when you go to a wedding, and the next morning a drug dealer says to you, you have a problem. Okay? You know. Because I got so smashed at this wedding we went to, which was not even a good friend, some guy from his family. I was laid out, totally drunk at this wedding in a couch. And so what happens is, you know, I knew things were getting bad. So now what happens, though, I'm supposed to pick her up and her daughter to go to, I was still trying to be dad, okay? My kids, I'd have them on the weekend, and I was party dad, meaning I would take them to Great Adventure, and I would do things with my kids, and my wife was, ex-wife was the real mom, had to do the hard work. So they loved me and hated her, and I was happy about that. So what happened was, though, I went to pick up Yvette at the time, and there was no answer at her door. So I said, there's something wrong. I called her pager, no answer on a pager. And we were supposed to be going away. And it turns out I went back there again and the police were at a door. So as it turns out, I didn't go in to speak to the police because I figured she just got popped for drugs. So it turns out she was murdered. Her roommate's ex-husband came in and shot her and the roommate and then killed himself. Now, I was talking to her at 11:30 on the phone, and I know she said to me, I'm in a lot of trouble, and I believe to this day that the guy was pointing a gun at her at that time, and I didn't know it. So at that point, having had lost a lot of people, went back into sort of a shell, meaning that now, like, the poor me's were upon me, and I started drinking and doing other assorted cousins of drinking very heavily. And I really was in a major depression. I stopped hanging out. When I first started drinking, I drank to be social. In the end, I was antisocial. You know, I lied about how much I drank when I first started. I used to say I drank more than I did. And in the end, I was lying, saying I was drinking less than I was. And all of the stuff, you know, you drink to get out of yourself, you wind up inside yourself. And I was my box was starting to close. And I was living tighter and tighter by myself. I stopped seeing my old friends. I was hanging out with a new class of crowd of people that I used to think were beneath me. And I was no better than them. And there I was. And it was in 86 that I hit a rehab again. I begged the job to get me in a rehab. I told them I had a drug problem. The guy said to me, I think you're an alcoholic. I said, no, I think I am a drug addict. He says, you're a Northern European, you're an alcoholic. And I was like, okay, fine. Send me to rehab. He sent me to rehab. It was a paid rehab. It was great. It was out in Brunswick House. And I sat out there. It was May. It was gorgeous. I was getting full pay for my job, and I heard everything I need to hear at these meetings. They had that big book up there, and they were talking about it, and I was listening, and I'm a pretty smart guy. And I'm like, I understand exactly what they're saying. I'm not buying the book, but I understand what they're saying, okay? I got it. I understand what this program's all about. There will be no problem. So I came back, and I was going to get, I had acquired another hostage at the time, another girlfriend, and I was going to get her straight, okay? And we know the story, okay? She got me, not that she got me, but I went down to the South Seaport, and we ordered a bottle of wine. Yeah, right. I'm a white wine drinker on the seaport. Within a short period of time, I was off to the races again, and I was out of control beyond belief. I just couldn't stop. I thought Satan had invaded my body. I would actually look myself in the mirror and say, oh, my God, you are out of control. Okay? I started actually for the first time bouncing checks, which I never did. I remember the guy coming to my door, knocking on my door. It was the mailman, and I had a landlord. It was a cop who was standing behind me, and the guy had certified mail, says, Dan Ryan there, and I was like, he don't live here. And I turned around, and there's the landlord, and I was like, shh. Yeah. Yeah. So all of a sudden, you know, my life that I thought was in good shape started unraveling before me, totally unraveling. And in January of 1987, I got to the point where I just said, you know what, this is impossible. I got two careers going on at Wall Street. I was still a manager, okay? And I got two careers going on, one getting high and one being a manager. One has to go. The job was going, okay? I got a bonus check and literally cashed that check. I'm not proud of it today. I robbed my landlord's house, and I headed into the streets, okay? And it was in 1987 that I basically, at that point, decided, you know what? I am like a cesspool whirlpool going down fast, and I didn't give a damn. I couldn't care if I died or not. I stopped seeing my kids, stopped paying child support, and I just went on a mad mission to pretty much kill myself. And all I really did was drink and do other assorted things on a daily basis, constantly. And I lived on rooftops. I remember I helped my friend do a moving job, and we helped the guy, and we got two air mattresses, okay? And he gave them to us. And I was like, this ain't too bad. My friend let me sleep in the back of his van. I had an air mattress. It's not that bad. This is what my mind was starting to think, okay? And I would take a shower every couple of days, help him with some work, and then go on tears. Unbelievable tears. Beyond belief, remorse would set in. You know, I'm sure many of you can identify with what was going on. It was out of control. And I literally lived that whole year. Every once in a while, you know, I would try to get it together, and it wouldn't happen, and then I'd be off to the races again. Once I took one sip of alcohol, I never knew when I was going to stop. So literally in November of 1987, after about 10 months out in the street, I was over in Bailey Seaton. I had gone back to my mother again and begged my mother to let me in. She had already changed the locks because I had robbed the house, stole my kids' piggy banks, all of that stuff that we do. And I begged her to please let me in. I couldn't sleep another night in the street. And she let me in under the pretense that I would leave the next day. And she gave me $30 to call a cab to go to Bailey Seaton Hospital. And I can tell you the demons were calling me just getting into that cab not to go. But I went. And I over there, you know, I wound up going through five days of detox, and I had nowhere to live. And they helped me find out about Graymore, which is a men's homeless shelter. And I was like, whatever, I give up. I surrender. I can't do this anymore. And I literally took, you know, the road up to Graymore, and that's where I was 19 years ago, walking up there with two brown bags of clothing, which they gave me, okay, and had to get sprayed down. And I was like, how did this happen to me? I was just a totally defeated human being, and I stood there completely depressed, terror, bewilderment, the four horsemen, they talk about it in the big book, which, of course, I had never read. And I stood up there, and I really basically said, I just really need help. I don't know why I'm here, but I know I can't go back to where I was. And I stayed up there, and, you know, they give you jobs like cleaning toilets and, you know, things like that. And that's what I needed. So, but I went to they have the brothers up there, and I went to the services, and they were doing the service, and I heard the brothers do the gospel, one of the gospels, and they're talking about Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is up in a tree. Jesus is walking along. Jesus stops, looks up in a tree, and says, Zacchaeus, please come down out of the tree. I want to enter into your home today. And at that very moment, I felt a wind rush through me. And it was, this is no lie. From that moment on, I had a psychic phenomenon change in my head that I knew I was going to be okay. And it was unbelievable. I was a little rattled. I was a little nervous about it. I thought it might have been one of those acid kickbacks coming. So I went up to the brother afterwards, and I said, listen, I really want to read scriptures. And he gave me one and said, here, but I suggest you also read the big book. And I was going to the meetings. I had meetings every day, and I heard this guy come in because I felt like a real loser. And that was bad for me because I'm a sports person. And he said up there, I know a lot of you guys feel like losers right now. And I was like, you bet your ass I do. And he said, you're not a loser. You're just losing today. And if you do what needs to be done and get on the winning team, which is quite a team here, you will be safe. And from that moment on, I decided I was going to do whatever it took to get my ass together. And I spent 7 weeks in Graymore. You're only allowed three. They let me stay for seven. And I know that was God's grace. And I decided they wouldn't let me go to St. Joe because I had mentioned I'd done some other things and you had to be only pure alcohol. And I said I did other things, so they wouldn't let me go there. And I wound up out in Creedmoor, which is a mental institution, but it was a rehab. And the guy out there said, let's face it, you are in a mental institution because of your thinking. And I was like, brother, I don't care what you say, man. Just help me get me saved. And I became a bit of a fanatic at the time. I was reading that big book like you wouldn't believe, okay? Even when I was in Graymore, I went to confession up there, and then I went again the next week, and the guy said to me, Dan, you were here last week. You don't have to confess again. You know, because that's how much I wanted to get everything out that I had. And I started reading the big book, and AA Comes of Age, Pass It On, all of those things. And it said back then, those people were going through the same things I did, and I was like overwhelmed. It was unbelievable what was happening. And I said, I'm going to do exactly what they did. I got a sponsor, and I started getting involved in the steps. I was still in a rehab. When I left rehab, I went to a halfway house because I said, you know what, they told me the first year, build a strong foundation. I wanted what you people had. And I went 9 months in a halfway house. I had to take antabuse. I didn't give a damn. Funny thing about it was I never got fired while I was out there. I got a job as a bookkeeper my first year, and I got fired. And I was like, I don't believe this. I get fired when I'm sober. Because I happened to be talking to my sponsor on the phone. So what happens was, I started getting involved, and I spent there. I joined a home group while I was in there, and I started making coffee in like three or four groups. I got very active. I was going to meeting double headers every night, 74th Street Workshop, all of the groups, everywhere, Mustard Seed, anywhere you could name, I was going to meetings. I was having meetings before the meeting after the meeting. Some people thought I got hit in the head with the Bible, but I didn't give a damn because I wanted what you had. And some people didn't, and if they didn't, I didn't care. I wanted to save my life. And literally, that was the start of an unbelievable journey for me. I mean, I got served with papers in AA, never to see my children again. I had to sit through court-ordered supervision in order to see my children with my wife and her ex-boyfriend sitting in the schoolyard watching me. But I got through it. My sponsor said, just pray for him. And I did. I prayed that he would go to heaven. The only thing is, I was hoping it was that day. Okay? We don't get too well too quick. But I went on a spiritual search because I was told that you needed to enlarge your spiritual life. I got very active in the book and did a lot of that work, but I also got involved. I wound up getting a job as a doorman. Now, for me, anybody here is a doorman, God bless you. I felt it was a step down. I was a manager in Wall Street. But you know what? I said, this is what I need. I did it for 5 years. I was running an elevator up on 2074th Street, okay? And I got to read and read the literature, read AA, read everything, get active, go to conventions, do all of that stuff. And amazing things were happening. My children were back in my life. Unbelievable things were happening. I actually cleaned up debt. You know, I had to file bankruptcy early on, but a lot of the things weren't that bad. And I wound up, just keep on doing that. I did on a very spiritual search. I consider myself a Christian, maybe, whatever. I don't follow any particular religion, but I do know love and service is the tenets of mostly every religion. They talked about you needed to be born again before you can enter the kingdom. The big book says you need to have a psychic phenomenal experience. in the spiritual appendage. And I was like, you know what? I agree with that. We need to be awakened from that old thinking. Okay, you can't pour new wine into an old wine sack. All the parables, I was reading them and I was tying them into AA, and amazing things were happening in my life. You know, friendships, you know. And that's how I live my life today. I started getting up an hour early before I went to work. I would light candles, read AA literature, and just sit there. I started doing something called the centering prayer. You know, all the stuff that I was learning, and it helped me, you know. And they said, you will know it's working not when you think God is talking to you, because he might sound a lot like Danny. It's when you start treating your fellow brothers and sisters with love in your heart, and you treat everybody you meet with a smile on your face, and you are willing to give, and you help another alcoholic like this group does, which is unbelievable. You know, and that's what I did. I try to do anyway. I'm not perfect. I slip up. But the design for living that the AA steps teach us, the 10, 11, you know, if you're incorporating that, I went through all the steps, did all of them, and I worked them today. If I'm feeling uncomfortable at night with somebody, blah, 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 and I think I did something wrong, I want to talk to them at least by the next day to straighten it out. And thank God, like I said, I don't really have many problems with anybody. You know, I have some people that annoy me in work, whatever, but I just deal with it. You know, I've learned a real key in my life is that the longer the distance from the point of stimuli to my response, the better response I make. Okay? If I respond immediately to you, it's normally going to be my old self. Like, say, you know the words. Okay? Otherwise, if I take time out and if I have to say, you know, Father, forgive them for they don't know what they do, you know, they're just sick people and hopefully they'll get better, or whatever. And take a look, as my sponsor teaches me, to look at my side of the street. You know, what is it about them that is irritating me that I can't accept? It's not about what they do, it's about what I do. And so all of you guys that, you know, are here early on, there is no reason that you have to go back out there again, okay? But you need to have honesty about what alcohol does when you pick it up, and I know when it picks up me. You know, when you hit Graymore, you pretty much know, you know, it's a little unmanageable, okay? You need to become open-minded that there is a power greater than yourself, whatever that you decide that to be, and it can't be you, that will restore your sanity, and you need to be willing to do the work. And the work is getting involved in the steps, getting involved in the fellowship, and doing all of that. And all I can guarantee you, what my sponsor guaranteed me, if you do that, your life will become beyond your wildest dreams, and you will be rocketed into the fourth dimension. Thanks a lot.